Welcome to the reading of the Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, for August 10th, 2022, on Wednesday, and I am your reader, Peter Welch. Stadium plan lands $12.5 million state grant. City of Dyersville is awarded a Destination Iowa grant to help fund a permanent facility at Field of Dreams. In Dyersville, the City of Dyersville on Tuesday was awarded a $12.5 million state grant for the creation of a permanent baseball stadium at the Field of Dreams. The grant is funded through Destination Iowa, a state program that uses funds from the Federal American Rescue Plan Act to give grants to community projects aimed at improving quality of life and attracting tourists and new residents. Dyersville officials applied for the funding earlier this year and intended to put it toward the creation of a permanent multi-use stadium capable of hosting professional baseball games, colleagues and amateur baseball tournaments, and other year-round events. I couldn't be happier for our community. It's a great opportunity, said Dyersville Mayor Jeff Jacques. It's an economic boon for Dyersville, Dubuque County, and the state of Iowa, and something we can all be proud of. Jacques Ray, Executive Director of Dyersville Economic Development Corps, noted that the grant announcement came in the midst of a busy week of festivities ahead of the second MLB game at the Field of Dreams on Thursday, August 11th, between the Chicago Cubs and the Cincinnati Reds. It fires up even more to continue to show the world and what a great place Iowa is, she said. We really appreciate the governor's support and her confidence in what the Field of Dreams can do for the state in attracting people here. A new nonprofit, this is Iowa Baseball or Ballpark Incorporated, will oversee the stadium and have a long-term lease agreement for the stadium's land with the Go the Distance Baseball, which owns the Field of Dreams. Press materials from Go the Distance Baseball state that this is Iowa Ballpark was established by a partnership consisting of Go the Distance Baseball Dubuque County, the cities of Dyersville and Dubuque, and Dyersville Economic Development Corporation. In a statement, this is Iowa Ballpark officials called the project a transgenerational once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to significantly enhance tourism and economic development on a local, regional, and statewide basis. The grant is one piece of the public and private funding that is necessary to turn the permanent stadium dream into reality, the statement went on to say. The award represents 25% of the total project investment of $50 million and will be used for stadium infrastructure. Both the Dyersville and Dubuque city councils previously pledged $1 million towards the project, while the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors pledged $5 million. Rahi said that local officials currently are working with several private funders who've expressed quite a bit of interest in the permanent stadium project. Plans call for the facility to have 3,000 permanent seats, and temporary seats could be added to bring the stadium up to 8,000 total seats. In 5 years, the stadium is projected to host approximately 70 events annually, according to the Go the Distance Baseball press materials. Rahi said that while the stadium will be built to professional baseball specifications, it also is intended to host other educational and cultural events, such as winter markets, concerts, camps, and corporate events. Some of the features of the stadium that lend themselves to professional sporting events also lend themselves very well to private parties and a myriad of other uses, all with the Field of Dreams in the backdrop, she said. Rahi said that the officials still are completing designs and engineering documents before construction can begin. In May, Dubuque County Board of Supervisors documents outlined a projected construction start date this fall, with completion by August 2024. In addition to the permanent stadium, the Field of Dreams site also is slated to see $80 million in projects and investments through Go the Distance Baseball, which were announced earlier this year. The master plan, to be completed in phases by 2025, includes a youth baseball complex with 9 new baseball and softball fields, dormitories for teams, a 104-room boutique hotel, an amphitheater, a recreational vehicle park, and jogging trails. Rahi said that the two developments will piggyback off one another to create a comprehensive experience for Field of Dreams guests. We can build upon one another's crowds and visitors and just give something for absolutely everyone to take part in, she said. Go the Distance baseball officials noted in a statement that the Destination Iowa grant affirms the organization's investment in the field. They said that this summer, 367 baseball teams representing 23 states came to play in the tournaments in the Dyersville area, a 240% increase over last year. This is just one of many indicators that people will continue to come, the statement went on to say, and they will come even in greater numbers once we have the improved infrastructure, facilities, and amenities completed in phases over several years, making the Field of Dreams movie site a world-class destination. And in other news, Chamber hosts Grassley in Dubuque. Senator discusses drug price strategies and airline woes during a politics and eggs event. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, discussed his preferred plan to bring down prescriptions, drug prices, difficulties addressing the nation's pilot shortage, and inconsistencies he sees in several recent federal bills at an event Tuesday in Dubuque. Grassley was the headliner of Dubuque's Area Chamber of Commerce's First Politics and Eggs event, a new series that will continue at 11 a.m. Thursday with U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican of Iowa, with both events being held at a Hotel Julian in Dubuque. At Tuesday's event, Grassley's responded to questions about how he would address the rising price of prescription drugs. In response, Grassley pointed to a bipartisan drug price bill he has co-sponsored that would create or reform 38 policies. One change would limit increases in drug prices to be no higher than the increases in the consumer price index. It has a section insulin that would do away the clawback pharmacy benefit managers put in and make their businesses more transparent, Grassley went on to say. It would put out of pocket cap on what people pay. It would save the taxpayers $95 million and consumers $72 million. Grassley also noted of a bill has co-sponsored that would direct the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission to investigate pharmacy benefit managers, companies that manage drug prices on behalf of insurance corporations and other payers, and authorize the commission to take legal action against them if wrongdoing is found. In an email after the event responding to Grassley's plans, Julie Stouch, campaign manager for retired U.S. Navy Vice Admiral Michael Franken, the Democrat running against Grassley in the November election, said that the senator had the chance to cap monthly insulin prices at $35 for Iowans versus the Inflation Reduction Act, which Senate Democrats advanced on Sunday. And he voted no because he's taken nearly $1.4 million from the drug industry. And he works in Washington to protect their profits, even if Iowans have to pay more for life-saving drugs, she said. After 63 years of excuses, Iowans see through his failure to lower health care costs, no matter what he says. During Tuesday's event, Grassley justified his vote against the Inflation Reduction Act by saying it would exacerbate already historic inflation. He also said that the Democrat bill could negate progress made with Congress passage of the CHIPS and Science Act, which President Joe Biden signed into law on Tuesday and in which Grassley also voted against. the CHIPS and Science Act provides $52.7 billion for American semiconductor research, development, manufacturing, and workforce development. The law also adds $39 billion in manufacturing incentives, $1.5 billion for wireless radio access networks, and $10 billion for regional innovation and technology hubs, along with other investments. It is a little bit inconsistent for 1 week Congress to pass the CHIPS bill and spend $272 billion to bring manufacturing back to the United States, then over the weekend pass a $740 billion bill with $400 and some billion being spent, he said, referring to the surplus in funds that would be raised by the Inflation Reduction Act. Grassley said the CHIPS Act, at least in its original form, would help the U.S. better compete with China in microchip manufacturing. Most of our most sophisticated chips we get from Taiwan, not China itself, he said. But if China would take over the economy there, that would be a terrible blow to our manufacturing. So we're trying to move some of that through. However, Grassley said he voted against the CHIPS and Science Act because Democrats dumped a whole bunch of other stuff into it. Jason White, Vice President of Business Services for Greater Dubuque Development Corporation, thanked Grassley for his efforts to try to prevent American Airlines' decision to end commercial service to Dubuque Regional Airport on the 7th of September, but challenged him to hold airlines accountable for federal investments during the pandemic. Over the last couple of years, the airline industry received millions of dollars of new subsidies from Congress, White said, and yet they're providing fewer and fewer services to fewer and fewer airports. There are dozens of airports right now, many with much less commercial airline business than Dubuque, that have protected status and continue to receive taxpayer dollars from airline providers. Grassley said that it might be too late for accountability, but that he would look for opportunities. We're 2 years late doing it because the $50 million they got through COVID's spent already, he said. We should have put accountability measures on that at that particular time, but I don't think we anticipated what we have now with the shortage of things. And now let's take a look at Dubuque and the tri-state area. News in brief. Dubuque secures $2.3 million for a downtown roadway project. Dubuque will receive nearly $2.3 million in grant funding for a major downtown roadway project from the U.S. Department of Transportation officials announced on Tuesday. The funding will go toward the design and engineering for a vehicle and pedestrian overpass to be located at the 14th Street Railroad crossing, improvements to 16th and Elm Street, and a new bike path to the Kerper Boulevard Industrial Park and Chaplin Schmidt Island. The grant comes from funding made available by the bipartisan infrastructure law passed last year by Congress and the fiscal year 2022 appropriations bill. Along with the planned overpass, city officials seek to reconstruct large portions of 16th Street from Elm Street to Admiral Sheehy Drive and Elm Street, and from the Five Point intersection with East 20th Street and Romberg Avenue to Kerper Boulevard. The project also would involve the installation of new sidewalks along the roadways and the construction of roundabouts at the intersections of 16th Street with Kerper Boulevard, with Admiral Sheehy Drive, and with Elm Street. Terry Goodman, Director of Strategic Partners, or Partnerships rather, for the City of Dubuque, wrote in an email response that the total cost of the project will be determined through the design and engineering funded by the grant. And another news from Dubuque. Busy Dubuque intersection opens to east and west traffic. A busy Dubuque intersection has partially reopened amid a months-long construction project on the Northwest Arterial. City officials announced Tuesday that the intersection of Ashby Road and Northwest arterial has reopened to eastbound and westbound traffic after being closed for repaving. Northbound and southbound traffic in the area will remain head-to-head in the southbound lanes through the end of the month. The work is part of an ongoing project to rehabilitate and reconstruct much of the Northwest arterial. After the intersection work is completed at Ashbury Road, crews will begin repaving the southbound lanes of Northwest Arterial from US 20 to John F. Kennedy Road. As much of this work as possible will be done at night, but there will be some lane shifts to accommodate construction, a press release states. Repaving the southbound lanes should be completed by the 15th of November. And in other local news in Dubuque, pedestrian struck, injured by a vehicle in Dubuque. Police said a pedestrian was struck by a vehicle and injured on Monday. David A. Welbies, age 79, of Platteville, Wisconsin, was transported by private vehicle to Southeast Health in Platteville for treatment of minor injuries, according to Dubuque police. Police said a vehicle was traveling south on Central Avenue at 5:49 a.m. when it turned left onto 5th Street and struck Welbies, who was crossing 5th Street legally in the crosswalk. The vehicle then left the scene. Police, the Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Department reports. Jeremy M. Creasy, age 40, no permanent address, was arrested at 6:54 p.m. Monday at Miller Riverview Park on a charge of second-degree harassment. Ryan M. Freeberger, age 32, of 2801 Bulk Street, was arrested at 11:33 a.m. Monday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on a warrant charging assault with injury. Court documents state that Freeberger assaulted Andrew Hogan, age 29, on July 28th in the Dubuque County Jail. And finally, in police news, Hy-Vee Gas Station 300 South Locust Street reported the theft of an item worth $1,283 between Saturday and Monday at the store. East Dubuque Council hears update on police station. In East Dubuque, Illinois, amid ongoing deterioration of East Dubuque's police station, city officials will begin moving evidence and other records out of the building. The station has been in disrepair for years, and officers have had the option to work out of City Hall since May 2021 after the building was deemed unsafe. However, City Manager Loris Herrig said earlier this summer that because of records are stored in the police station, officers found it difficult to constantly go back and forth. But the continued deterioration of the building now has forced the departments to prepare to remove records and other materials from the premises, Police Chief Luke Koviak said on City Council meeting this week. While this last rainstorm that we had, we lost about another half dozen ceiling tiles in our police station, he went on to say. It's now starting to leak into an office which is right next to the evidence room. So pretty soon, we're going to need to start moving evidence by a more secure location so that we can preserve what we've got. Herrig said that city officials intended to move materials into the conference room at City Hall. The city previously had considered temporarily housing the department in trailers or leased space, but officials have been unable to find an available location that is not cost prohibitive. We'll make home for them for a lack of better option, Herrig went on to say. We've talked to everybody that we can find to see if we can find a spot for them, and there's just nothing available. City officials plan to construct a new police station and fire station on vacant lots off Cincinnawa Avenue with a total estimation cost of $7 million. After the meeting, Herrig said that the officials anticipate putting the fire station project out for bids this fall, with the police station to follow at a later date. Construction of the fire station could begin in the spring and be completed by the end of 2023, while the schedule for the police station will depend on when the bidding process begins. And let's turn to some other tri-state news right now. County energy coaches to provide efficiency tips. Minority residents and those in rural areas will be given priority. Dubuque County supervisors approved funding to train a trio of coaches to improve energy efficiency in rural and underserved areas, part of a broader shift alongside neighboring counties to help residents combat rising utility costs. The Dubuque County Energy District will receive $55,225 to teach three individuals to conduct assessments of residential energy use and provide recommendations to residents and business owners to reduce their energy costs. One coach will further train to become Energy Star certified through the Department of Energy to conduct farm and business coaching sessions. The county will pay 80% of the training fees for all coaches and 90% of fees for the Energy Star certification. The county also will cover the cost of 54 residential and 27 farm or business coaching sessions at no cost to residents or business owners. Energy District Program Coordinator Michael Freeberger said that the program will prioritize rural and minority individuals who often pay a higher portion of income on energy expenses than others. It's focused on those who are last on the energy transition, Freeberger says. Coaching sessions will consist of guidance on reducing energy burden, including conducting appliance inventories, advice on how to seek utility rebates and tax incentives, connecting individuals with solar and other clean energy opportunities like Renew Dubuque, as well as day-to-day tips and tricks. We can implement some LED lights here. Your air conditioning doesn't have the efficiency it could. Stuff like that, said Energy District Board Member Jacob Lucas. Lucas said that he expected the county to seek out applicants with experience conducting home inspections and with electrical equipment such as home inspectors, electricians, and HVAC technicians. The program follows similar initiatives underway in Winchique and Clayton counties, as well as Green Iowa AmeriCorps' First Step Efficiency Program. The city of Dubuque also is conducting energy audits via housing inspectors, as well as Teen Vigilance Corps. Dubuque and other counties move to take a more active role in energy efficiency comes amid rising utility rates and a 2018 decision by the state legislature to reduce the amount utilities were mandated to spend on improving energy efficiency. All of this energy coaching is recognizing the negative impacts of the Senate file in 2018, Freeberger says. Our neighbors are watching their energy rates and their energy usage go up as well. The Energy District plans to select its trainees by October and complete training by June 30th of next year. District officials also plan to seek state and federal funding in 2023 and 2024, but are waiting to complete budgeted coaching sessions. Right now, we have to show Dubuque County that has interest in these rural energy audits before we can apply for federal dollars, Freeberger said. And in other local news, COVID-19 vaccination rates remain low among area youth. Youth COVID-19 vaccination rates remain low across the tri-state area as a new school year approaches, a trend that has area officials on alert for the possibility of back-to-school spread. Even other illnesses like strep throat and colds tend to spread among kids who haven't seen each other for a while, said Lafayette County, Wisconsin Health Director Julie LaFried. It would be nice if we could increase our percentage of kiddos who are fully up to date on their COVID-19 vaccination. Nationwide, the most recent data shows that 30% of kids age 5 through 11 are fully vaccinated, as well as 60% of those 12 through 17. Across the Telegraph Herald's 10-county coverage area, Iowa County, Wisconsin, is the only county exceeding these rates, with most others falling far below. There's definitely room for improvement, said Mary Rose Corrigan, public health specialist for the city of Dubuque, since families have an opportunity to be fully vaccinated at all ages now. We should take advantage of that. While low COVID-19 vaccination rates among children has vexed officials for months, it's become especially worrisome for them ahead of the start of school when kids are exposed to new classmates. Area school districts are monitoring vaccination rates and new case numbers, as well as waiting for further guidance from state and federal health agencies. We're keeping an eye on vaccination levels at a broad community level, but we don't have any more information than the general public, said Allie White, health services coordinator with Dubuque Community Schools. As a district, we do encourage our families to consider the COVID vaccine and do what's best for their family. To try to increase vaccination rates, area health departments are holding community clinics for youth vaccinations, as well as using social media to promote vaccine education. Health officials also urge parents who have concerns about the COVID-19 vaccine to talk with their child's pediatrician. It's not a bad idea for parents to look into getting their kids vaccinated right now, said Grant County, Wisconsin Health Department Director Jeff Kendray, who added that all of his kids were vaccinated for COVID-19 without complications. It's a good discussion to have with your primary care provider. Well, let's take a look now at lifestyle. Food, to be specific. Psychedelic art and veggies. San Francisco pop-up, the Mushroom Boat's unique blend. San Francisco, you're sipping natural wine in a dining room where the walls, tables, and staff are covered in green, a tower of grilled and roasted squash layered with electric purple potato puree has been placed before you on a pink plate. Star-shaped radish and black sesame hummus sandwiches surround this miniature tree-like fallen leaves, and sugar snap pods filled with carrot puree rest at its base, like logs in a psychedelic forest. This is the Mushroom Vegan Pop-Up, marrying food and art in a way San Francisco has never seen. Chef Alex Lorizon and co-owner Frank Valdez pair eclectic ceramics with bright vegan cuisine and what can only be described as living art. Lorizon started the five-course dinners, $200, including wine and service, highlighting those handcrafted ceramics last summer, and has watched as each dinner sells out with waiting lists long as your arm. Find details for the latest dinner on their Instagram page. The Mushroom has not only mobilized a community of art-loving vegans, but also restaurant workers hoping to collaborate with Lorizon and Valdez. The duo is in search of a permanent space where by year's end you'll be able to order signature dishes like the phyllo dough mushroom pie made with yellow split pea shayu and spring pea miso a la carte for lunch or dinner. The squash tower will be on the menu as well. Lorizon is a native of Utah, comes from the fashion world. He moved to San Francisco in 2017 after living in New York and Paris. A stint at Rose Bakery in both cities sealed his future in food. Valdez is a Southern California native. He attended design school in L.A. and moved to San Francisco in 2015, landing a job at Legendary Health Ceramics, best known for its tableware. At Heath, he worked in product development and helped to open its first soft goods studio in its San Francisco factory. Valdez is now on the design team at Bagu, also in San Francisco. The two came together when Lorizon asked Valdez to sew aprons and napkins for the first mushrooms. Lorizon goes on to say that we want a space of our own, but we don't want to rush anything. For us, the most eye-opening part of this is how excited people are about it. The majority of our guests are in the art, design, or food world, and I don't think there are enough spaces in San Francisco that bring creatives together. Our main goal is to make San Francisco an exciting and vibrant place. We can reminisce about its heyday, but ultimately, it is what you make it. We have big plans and a lot of ideas about the future. You are listening to the reading of the Telegraph Herald on Wednesday, August 10th, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And I am your speaker, Peter Welch. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Robert Henry Bob Walhart passed peacefully on August 6th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, surrounded by family. Visitations will be from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. Friday, August 12th, St. Columbkille Catholic Church, where there will be a prayer service at 6:45 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 13th, at St. Columbkille Catholic Church, with Reverend David Schatz officiating, and will be live streamed on Bob's obituary page at www.EGELHOFSIEGERTCASPER.com. There'll be no public visitation on Saturday. James E. and Donna J. Mueller have passed at the age of 76, Donna 75, and James age 76, of Janesville, Wisconsin, Thursday, August the 4th, and Friday, August 5th, in Lafayette Park, Washington, D.C., as a result of an unfortunate lightning strike. A Mass of Christian burial will be held at 2 p.m. on Friday, August 12th, at St. William Catholic Church in Janesville, Wisconsin, with Reverend James Leeser officiating. Visitation for family and friends will be held from 9:30 a.m. to 1:45 p.m. Friday at the church. Henry Lampier of Epworth, Iowa, has passed at the age of 88 at his home in Epworth, Iowa. Visitation for Henry will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, August 11th, at the Reef Funeral Home in Epworth, Iowa. Visitation will also be held after 9 a.m. on Friday at the funeral home. Services for Henry will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday, August 12th, at the Reef Funeral Home in Epworth, Iowa, with Pastor Mike Jones presiding. Margaret Smith, age 81, of Dubuque, has passed of natural causes at Lantern Park Care Initiative in Coralville, Iowa. Visitation will be from 2 p.m. until 4 p.m. on Saturday, August 13th, Hoffman Schneider in Kitchen Funeral Home, and cremation services at 3860 Ashbury Road in Dubuque. The funeral service to celebrate Maggie's life will be at 4 p.m. on Saturday, August 13th, at Hoffman Schneider in Kitchen Funeral Home and cremation services. Burial will occur at a later date at the East Dubuque Cemetery. Victoria Rizzoffi has passed at the age of 60 on Tuesday, July 26th. A celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, the 13th of August, by the Galena Generals and the Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena. Friends may gather after 9 a.m. until the time of service. Burial will be on a later date. Cremation rites have been accorded as well. Now let's turn to some national news. FBI search of Trump home raises questions. In Washington, the year was 2016. The presidential candidate under investigation was Hillary Clinton. And the FBI director at the time, James Comey, laid out the factors that the Justice Department weighs in deciding whether to charge someone with mishandling classified records. Fast forward to 2022, and the tutorial proves instructive as another candidate from that election, Donald Trump, is entangled in an FBI probe related to sensitive government documents. Whether an FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence is a prelude to criminal charges is unknown. The action Monday nonetheless focuses attention on the thicket of statutes that govern the handling of government records. Though the department's own history of prosecutorial discretion, some high-profile investigations have ended without charges or in misdemeanor plea deals, makes it hard to forecast with certainty what might happen this time. These are statutes that have historically not been enforced to the fullest extent, said University of Texas law professor Stephen Valdick. To obtain a search warrant, the Justice Department would have had to persuade a judge that probable cause existed, that a crime was committed, though what statute officials think may have been violated is unclear. One potentially relevant statute makes it a crime to remove classified information and retain it at an unauthorized location. Another makes it illegal to mishandle either willfully or through gross negligence national defense information, including maps, photographs, documents, or transmit it to an unauthorized person. But the mere mishandling of a classified information isn't always enough for a felony conviction or any charges at all. It often comes down to whether there are aggravating factors in these cases, said David Loffman, a Washington lawyer who, as head of the Justice Department's Counterintelligence and Export Control Section, oversaw the Hillary Clinton investigation. Those include, he said, how much classified information was mishandled, the extent to which the person knew they were in possession of classified information, and how sensitive the material was, and whether its exposure placed a risk on U.S. national security. The FBI said as much in 2016, when it closed without recommending charges an investigation into whether Clinton mishandled classified information via a private email server she used as a Secretary of State. Comey said that agents had determined that she had sent and received emails containing classified information, but that there was no indication that she intended to break the law. He said no reasonable prosecutor would have brought such a case. And let's turn to some other news in Washington regarding the court. Congress can now have Trump tax records in Washington. A federal appeals court sided on Tuesday with a House committee seeking access to former President Donald Trump's tax returns, rejecting Trump's contention that Congress was overstepping. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Courts of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit agreed with a lower court judge's decision in favor of Congress. U.S. District Judge Trevor McFadden, a former Justice Department official and Trump appointee, ruled in December that the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee has broad authority to request the records, and that the Treasury Department should provide the tax returns to the committee. The three appeals court judges agree. The Trump parties contend that the chairman's request exceeds Congress's investigative powers. It does not, the judge wrote. Two of the judges, David Santel and Karen Henderson, were appointed by President Ronald Reagan, and one, Robert Wickens, was appointed by President Barack Obama. In their ruling, the judges also rejected Trump's argument that the request was problematic in part because it didn't include a promise to keep the records confidential. It wasn't immediately clear whether Trump would appeal or whether there'd be a resolution of the case before a new Congress takes office in January. If Republicans recapture control of the House in the fall election, they could drop the request for records next year. The House Ways and Means panel and its chairman, Democrat Richard Neal of Massachusetts, first requested Trump's tax returns in 2019 as part of an investigation into the Internal Revenue Service's audit program and tax laws compliance by the former president. A federal law says that the Internal Revenue Service shall furnish the returns of any taxpayer to a handful of top lawmakers. With great patience, we followed the judicial process, and yet again, our position has been affirmed by the courts, Neal said in a statement. I'm pleased that this long-anticipated opinion makes clear that the law is on our side. When we receive the returns, we will begin the oversight of the IRS's mandatory presidential audit program. The committee said that it expected to receive the requested documents immediately. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called the decision an important victory for the rule of law. An email to Trump's attorney was not returned. The Justice Department under the Trump administration had defended a decision by the Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin to withhold the tax returns from Congress. Mnuchin argued that he could withhold the documents because he concluded they were being sought by Democrats for partisan reasons. And now let's turn to some world news. Afghan man charged in killing of two Muslims. A 51-year-old man from Afghanistan was charged Tuesday with killing two Muslim men in Albuquerque, New Mexico, authorities said, and he is suspected in the slaying of two others whose deaths sparked fear in Muslim communities nationwide. Officials announced the arrest of Mohammed Saeed a day after he was taken into custody. Police Chief Harold Medina said authorities had tracked down a vehicle believed to be involved in one of the slayings in New Mexico's largest city. The driver was detained, and he is our primary suspect for the murders, the tweet went on to say. Investigators received tips from the city's Muslim community that pointed them toward Saeed, who arrived in the U.S. sometime in the past several years, police say. The motive and exact nature of the relationships between Saeed and the victims to one another remain unclear, but police continued to investigate how they crossed paths before the shootings. Detectives discovered evidence that shows that the offender knew the victims to some extent, and an interpersonal conflict may have led to the shootings, police say. The slayings drew the attention of President Joe Biden, who said such attacks have no place in America, through Muslim communities where some people questioned their safety and limited their movements. When told about the announcement, Mohammed Hussein, brother of one of the victims, Mohammed Afizel Hussein, said that he felt relieved but needed to know more about the suspect and the motive. This gives us hope that we will have the truth come out, he said. We need to know why. Back to the U.S. in Corona, California, to escape after plane lands on Southern California freeway. A single-engine airplane landed and caught fire Tuesday on a Southern California freeway, and the pilot and passenger were able to escape safely, authorities say. The Piper PA-32 was flying to Corona Municipal Airport when the pilot reported engine trouble and landed in eastbound lanes of State Route 91 in Riverside County, according to the Federal Aviation Administration. Local TV news showed footage of the plane upright but engulfed in flames on the freeway near Corona. No injuries were reported. The pilot, Andrew Cho, told the Southern California News Group that he and his passenger had time to get out before the flames spread. Cho, age 54, said that he had taken off from Corona Airport about an hour earlier and were planning to return when the engine suddenly lost power. There was an empty spot on the freeway, so we went for that, Cho said. Thank God we really didn't hit anybody. The plane clipped the left rear of a Toyota Tundra pickup. Cho said that he's the co-owner of the Piper. The FAA said it was investigating. And now let's go to the other side of the country, over in Concord, New Hampshire. Jury acquits truck driver in deaths of seven motorcyclists. A jury on Tuesday acquitted a commercial truck driver of causing the deaths of seven motorcyclists in a horrific head-on collision in northern New Hampshire that exposed fatal flaws in the processing of license revocations across the states. Waldemir Zukowski, age 26, of West Springfield, Mass., was found innocent on seven counts of manslaughter, seven counts of negligent homicide, and one count of reckless conduct in connection with the June 21, 2019 crash in Randolph. Jailed since the crash, he appeared to wipe away tears as the verdict was read and briefly raised his index finger skyward before leaving the courtroom. Jurors deliberated for less than 3 hours after a two-week trial during which prosecutors argued that Zavosky, who had taken heroin, fentanyl, and cocaine earlier in the day of the crash, repeatedly swerved back and forth before the collision and told police he'd caused it. But a judge dismissed eight charges related to whether he was impaired, and his attorneys blamed the lead biker, Albert Woody Mazza Jr., saying that he was drunk and not looking where he was going when he lost control of his motorcycle and slid in front of Zavosky's truck. In closing statements Tuesday, the two sides raised questions about who was more all over the place, the trucker accused of swerving back and forth across the road or the eyewitnesses accused of contradicting each other. Those witnesses were all over the place about what they recalled and what they claimed to have seen, said defense attorney Jay Dugway. Dugway also accused prosecutors of ignoring that their own accident reconstructions unit contradicted their theory that Zavosky crossed into the oncoming lane. From the beginning of the investigation, the state had made up their mind about what had happened. Evidence be damned, said Dugway, who also highlighted inconsistencies between witnesses' accounts or when witnesses contradicted themselves. Now let's turn to some business news. Inflation likely to stay high even as gas falls. Various other economic developments threaten to keep intensifying pressures. In Washington, Americans may finally be catching a break from relentlessly surging prices, if such a slight one, even as inflation is expected to remain painfully high for months. Thanks largely to falling gas prices, the government's inflation report for July, to be released today, is expected to show that prices jumped 8.7% from a year earlier, still a sizzling pace, but a slowdown from the 9.1% year-over-year figure in June, which has the highest in four decades. The forecast by economists, if it proves correct, would raise hopes that inflation might have peaked and that the run of punishingly high prices is beginning to ease slightly. There have been other hopeful signs, too, that the pace of inflation might be moderating. At the same time, an array of other economic developments are threatening to keep intensifying inflation pressures. The pace of hiring is robust, and average wages are up sharply. And even as gas prices fall, inflation in services such as healthcare, rents, and restaurant meals is accelerating. Price changes in services tend to be sticky and don't ease as quickly as they do for gasoline, food, or other goods. Those trends suggest that overall inflation may not drop significantly anytime soon. President Joe Biden has already pointed to falling gas prices as a sign that his policies, such as release of oil from the nation's strategic reserve, are helping combat the higher costs that have hammered household budgets, particularly for lower-income families. Yet Republicans will push ongoing high inflation as a top campaign issue in this fall's elections, with polls showing that high prices have driven Biden's approval ratings down sharply. On Friday, the House is poised to give final congressional approval to a revived tax and climate package, pushed by Biden and Democratic lawmakers. The bill, which among other things aims to ease pharmaceutical prices by letting the government negotiate Medicare's drug costs, is expected to cut the federal deficit budget by $300 billion over a decade. Yet economists say that the measure, which its proponents have titled the Inflation Reduction Act, will have only a minimal effect on inflation over the next several years, though it could slow price increases a bit more later this decade. Economists have forecast that Wednesday's inflation report will show the consumer prices rose 0.2% from June to July, according to FactSet. That would mark a steep drop from the 1.3% jump from May to June. But excluding the volatile food and energy categories, so-called core inflation likely stayed high. Economists project that core prices rose 0.5% in July, still a sharp rise, though down from 0.7% jump in June. Such an increase would leave core prices at 6.1% higher than a year ago, up from 5.9% a year-over-year increase in June. And let's take a look now at an article out of Detroit regarding electric vehicles. It says that most electric vehicles won't qualify for federal tax credit. In Detroit, a tax credit of up to $7,500 could be used to defray the cost of an electric vehicle under the Inflation Reduction Act, now moving toward final approval in Congress. But the auto industry is warning that the vast majority of EV purchases won't qualify for a tax credit that large. That's mainly because of the bill's requirement that to qualify for the credit, an electric vehicle must contain a battery built in North America with minerals mined or recycled on the continent. And those rules become more stringent over time, to the point where in a few years it's possible that no EVs could qualify for tax credits, says John Bozella, CEO of the Alliance of Automotive Innovation, a key industry trade group. As of now, the Alliance estimates that about 50 of the 72 electric, hydrogen, or plug-in hybrid models that are sold in the U.S. wouldn't meet the requirements. So the $7,500 credit might exist on paper, Bozzola says in a statement, but no vehicles will qualify for this purchase over the next few years. The idea behind the requirement is to incentivize domestic manufacturing and mining to build a robust battery supply chain in North America and lessen the industry's dependence on overseas supply chains that could be subject to disruptions. Production of lithium and other minerals are used to produce EV batteries is now dominated by China and the world's leading producer of cobalt. Another component of the EV batteries is the Democratic Republic of Congo. Though electric vehicles are a part of global effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, they require metallic elements known as rare earths, found in places like Myanmar, where an Associated Press investigation has found that the push for green energy has led to environmental destruction. Under the $740 billion economic package, which passed the Senate over the weekend and is nearing approval in the House, the tax credits would take effect next year. For an EV buyer to qualify for the full credit, 40% of the metals used in the vehicle's battery must come from North America. By 2027, that required threshold would reach 80%. And finally, in our news today, in Washington, Biden signs $280 billion CHIPS Act in bid to boost U.S. over China. Bipartisan bill aims to bolster high-tech manufacturing in the U.S. In Washington, President Joe Biden on Tuesday signed a $280 billion bipartisan bill to boost domestic high-tech manufacturing, part of his administration's push to boost U.S. competitiveness over China. Flanked by scores of lawmakers, union officials, local politicians, and business leaders, Biden feted the legislation a core part of his economic agenda that will incentivize investments in the American semiconductor industry and an effort to ease U.S. reliance on overseas supply chains for critical cutting-edge goods. The future of the chip industry is going to be made in America, Biden went on to say in a sweltering Rose Garden ceremony Tuesday, referring to the diminutive devices that power everything from smartphones to computers to automobiles. The legislation set aside $52 billion specifically to bolster the U.S. computer chip sector. And that just about does it here for the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for August 10th, 2022 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. I am your speaker, Peter Welch. Thank you so much for listening, and have a terrific day.